Good day. What do we got here? It's March 8th. Where's the time going? 2023, Wednesday. Welcome to the Corey Morgan Show. I am, of course, Corey Morgan. Lots going on today. A little bit different. We usually check in with Dave for the news. We usually have a lot more of me covered stories and things, and I will do some ranting and raving. But I have three guests on today, so there's not going to be as much time to listen to me because these guests all have far more important things to say, so I'll be asking them the questions, and it's really good. To start with, in a short while, I'm going to have Alberta's Chief Firearm Officer, Terry Bryant, on the show. We're going to talk about Bill 8. That's a bill that the Alberta government has just dropped. The Western Standard got the exclusive on that, and it's now the provincial response to the federal firearm legislation, how we can protect Alberta's citizens, I guess, from federal incursion on that. There's limitations, and we'll see with that role as a firearms officer what Ms. Bryant plans on doing about it. And then retired paramedic Don Sharp, he's going to come on the show. He'll be here in person. We've had him on before because, again, we got a lot of reforms that are being proposed or tried. I mean, we know the ambulance times, the EMS response times are just way out of bounds. They are not nearly fast enough. And, I mean, you know, that's something as critical as it gets. And it sounds like AHS, the Alberta Health Services, is really kind of throwing sand in the gears for attempted reforms and efforts to try and do things to speed this up, as well as, of course, the NDP and others on this issue. So Donna lends a lot of experience to that issue, of course, as a paramedic, and he's retired, so he can speak out. And he's just, of course, concerned about getting people safe service, emergency service, when they need it. This is going on across the whole country, and we need to talk about it here. And then finally, I'll finish the show up with Chelsea Petrovic. She's running, she's the mayor of Claresholm and running for the nomination in Livingston-McLeod for the UCP. And she's had some questions about vaccination and things that we'll talk about as things go on. So use that comment scroll, guys. Fire some questions my way. I might not get them all to the guests or respond to all of them, but I do see them all, and I appreciate it. Good to see you all there. Paradoxy, Stewie, Sean, Kevin, all you guys checking in. It reminds me that I'm not just talking to myself like I do when I'm in the car. I'm actually got an audience there, and you guys are engaged and you're taking part. Just keep things civil, of course. That's the only thing I ask. You know, we don't have to be at each other's throats. Use Twitter for that. All right. Speaking of getting the throat, so I'm going to get on Justin Trudeau's throat a little bit here. Justin Trudeau, he's ragging the puck. He's deking, dodging, and delaying right now with the hope that the public interest in the Chinese Communist Party interference in Canadian elections goes away. And it's been interesting to watch. I mean, it was more broken from a Global Reporter this morning, another CSIS leak, two more documents. It's a form of Chinese water torture. These leaks just keep coming and hitting Trudeau day after day after day after day. So that's fine. We can't let Trudeau get away with burying this. I mean, Trudeau and other defenders of his government keep pointing to a report saying the CCP interference didn't impact the outcome of the election, thus we must just let it go. Now, while the impact of the meddling might not have changed which party formed government, it's impacted individual races, and it's certainly impacted Canadian trust in the entire system. We can't let him get away with this and let it go. I mean, Trudeau mentioned that there's 1.7 million Chinese Canadians, people of Chinese descent in Canada. But then he devolved into implying any further questions on the CCP meddling could bring a racist backlash against those Canadians. And that's a load of hogwash. In fact, you know, that number of Canadians of Chinese descent in Canada is significant, and it's large, and they're good citizens. And they're the top victims of the CCP meddling in Canada. Most of those who immigrated to Canada from China did so to escape the authoritarian communist government of their former homeland. And these Canadians shouldn't have to live in fear that the CCP can still impact their lives within this new homeland. And they have reasons to be fearful. The integration of the CCP in the Canadian society, and it goes well beyond our elected officials. They've infiltrated the business community, cultural communities, and now they're, of course, meddling with our elections. They're practicing a campaign of intimidation upon Canadians of Chinese descent. Recent reports expose the presence of as many as 5 Chinese police stations within Canada. These stations are used to intimidate and influence Chinese Canadians and Falun Gong adherents on Canadian soil. This is serious stuff. Imagine being a Canadian of Chinese descent who still has family back in China. You don't want to bring adverse attention to your loved ones back there, of course, and you want to ensure you can keep visiting them. So imagine these Chinese Canadians having issues with their immigration status or a travel visa renewal or a passport renewal. Normally, a person would go to their local member of parliament's office for help with these kinds of issues. But with CSIS reporting as many as 11 MPs that we know of may be compromised by the CCP, how comfortable would these Chinese Canadians feel in entrusting their information to the offices of their MPs? And what about the innocent MPs? I mean, there's several MPs of Chinese descent that have nothing to do with the Chinese Communist Party. But whether it's fair or not, some people might be questioning their loyalties. These MPs need the air cleared so they don't have to endure further mistrust. I know many people don't have faith in what can be accomplished with a public inquiry. We've seen enough government efforts to whitewash issues and stack inquiries, as it is to make people cynical. But it's still the best tool we've got right now to shed light on this controversy. And the opposition parties need to step up. They can't just keep asking for one. They have to force the issue in Parliament. Trudeau's in a minority government position. He can't stop an inquiry if the other parties get together and invoke it. I mean, sure, Trudeau could declare the vote of confidence issue. Good for him. Force an election, really? I mean, even somebody as arrogant and tone-deaf as Trudeau has to understand that dragging Canadians to a sudden election just to avoid a public inquiry into himself would be political suicide. And maybe the rot doesn't run too deeply. Maybe we've already seen the extent of the CCP interference and an inquiry wouldn't identify any more issues. I mean, that'd be a great outcome. We could then return to focusing on policy issues and quit dedicating so much time to the interference scandal. Trust in Canada's democratic system has been breached. And this distrust can't be left to fester. It undercuts the stability of the entire nation. Trudeau's games and ridiculous suggestions of appointing a special rapporteur must be dismissed. Who's it going to be? Margaret Trudeau? One of his brothers or something? Come on, Justin. Nobody's going to take the conclusions of an appointee of the Prime Minister seriously. It's bad enough already that a former head of the Trudeau Foundation was tasked with watching over the integrity of the elections. Trudeau won't participate. That's a given. The ball is in the court of the opposition party now. They need to do their jobs and force a full, public, independent inquiry headed by somebody approved by all the parties. And if the opposition parties won't do this, well, then Canada is truly broken. Now, that's where I'm at today, guys. Yeah, those leaks were something else. That fellow Tom, boy, his name's escaping me, of course, once I get on the live show, but he's with Global. He's been doing fantastic work, and he's been somebody just keeps leaking it to him. Bit after bit after bit. The latest one is very damning. I mean, Trudeau was he was dodging and deking, as I said, but he's saying, I didn't know anything about it. I was never briefed. Well, two documents came forth that showed, no, he was indeed briefed. And the Privy Council was. They were well aware of this issue. They were well aware of the problem, and they chose not to do anything about it. This is damning. This is devastating. This is very, very serious. And I suspect whoever this leak is, whoever it is with CSIS that keeps slow feeding this information to this reporter with Global, I don't think they want to leak any more than they have to. I mean, there's some people, liberal partisans and others saying, you know, this person's committing treason and they should be charged and they should be hunted down. I mean, yes, there's nothing worse than a whistleblower, isn't there? Especially when it's exposing your own misdeeds. But I don't think this person wants to blow the whistle any more than they have to, by the looks of it. They could have released all of this stuff and probably more right away, but they just want to get enough out there to force this issue to be addressed, for somebody to make an inquiry, get into it, find out just what happened, who knew what, where, how. Pardon me. So we're watching this unfold. And I think Prime Minister Trudeau hasn't been getting very much sleep lately, because every time they think something's... been settled, another leak comes out. And you see, here's some of the cynicism, and I don't blame it. From Karen Mitchell saying, all documents will be blacked out. We know nothing will happen as long as I think you meant Singh supports him. Well, excuse me. I don't know. I mean, we've seen so much redacted crap and everything from the government, but yeah, Singh is the problem. He's the one. He's got the power. He's the kingmaker. And he can force this to be a real independent inquiry. They can appoint somebody with the power to compel testimony, to compel documents, to say, this will be exposed, unredacted. It can be done. Now, whether or not it will be done, I mean, again, remains to be seen. And we've seen enough of this garbage that comes from the government. Oh, here's your Freedom of Information request, and here it comes back. And yeah, it's all black. Like, even trying to find out who spent $6,000 a night to stay in a hotel room, that one came back redacted as well with the Taxpayers Federation. But we've got to keep trying. I mean, the only other option is giving up, and I'm not into that. So we keep pushing. We keep trying to find out what's happened, and we carry on with it. I see Terry in the lobby. I'm not sure if her video's working yet, but she's going to be coming on as a guest shortly to talk about Bill 8. And I believe she's our chief firearm officer in Alberta. And she's been in Ontario, in Ottawa, speaking to some of the things with the Ottawa bill of C-21, which is, of course, the bill that's looking to control and seize and illegalize a great number of firearms that were previously legal in Canada. Perhaps if we could bring Terry in and see if we've got audio of her, and we can discuss this. I'm not sure if we've if she can hear me there or not, but we could find out in a moment, and we could discuss that because I got a really tight timeline today. So let's see if we can hear from our chief firearms officer, Terry Bryant.
Can you hear me?
Oh, okay. There. I can hear you, Terry. So yeah, we can't see you.
Well,
but we can hear you, and that's most important. How are you doing? Oh, I seem to have lost her. Okay, I did hear her speak at one moment there.
Canadian Shooting Sports Association. Without the CSSA, our gun rights would have been taken long, long ago. These guys are on the front lines, helping to draft smart and intelligent firearms regulations and legislation in Canada. And more importantly, educating the public about how we keep guns out of the hands of the wrong people. To become a member, it's absolutely worth every penny.
Okay, let's try that again. It is one of our sponsors, the Canadian Shooting Sports Association. They are a good group standing up for your rights as firearm owners. Check them out, guys. If you value your firearm rights, you must have a membership with those guys to stand up for things. Let's see if we can. Well, we can't. The mic doesn't seem to be connected.
I'm here.
Oh, we got you. I hear you now. Do you hear me, Terry?
I'm hearing you fine. I'm seeing you fine. And all I see for me on the right side of my screen is a giant blackness, but at least you can hear my voice.
Okay, well, the most important parts are what you can say, but it was great when we had you in studio that last time. It's much easier to see, but I appreciate you coming on today. I know that we can get some glitches technically when things are a remote interview like this, so I really appreciate you taking some time to speak to us today when you're on the road like this.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So what I do want to get into then is Bill 8 that came out with the provincial government recently. It's sort of, I guess, in response to federal legislation, and it offers some different authority and powers to your role as the chief firearms officer in Alberta. Can you kind of expand on what that's about?
Sure. So really the bill does two things. One is that when our office took over in September of 2021, I had a larger mandate than most chief firearms officers because I was supposed to advocate for change, something that's explicitly forbidden to many chief firearms officers. And that was only in a mandate letter. But this puts it actually in legislation so that it's entrenched, a stable continuity sort of situation where this will be definitely part of the job of the chief firearms officer of Alberta. And then the second thing that it does is provide us with a couple of ways of protecting Albertans in case some of these federal laws that we've been opposing actually end up being passed despite all the evidence indicating they shouldn't be.
Okay, so would you be acting, I guess, like one of the first things it talks about in the bill is limiting the municipalities and municipal police forces from entering into firearms-related funding agreements with the federal government. Would your role be partially maybe a liaison with these municipalities and police forces so they understand where their role is going to be going forward with firearm legislation and enforcement?
Well, I think that's probably somewhat outside my role, although just about anything related to firearms ends up being referred to me for at least some opinion. But the point of that part of the law is to ensure that there is some consistency, that you don't have one municipality going along with something and another municipality not going along and people getting a better deal in one place than they get in another place. So this ensures that there is some consistency on the side of the province in terms of whatever happens with this federal law.
Yeah, and just to clarify things, I mean, again, you're supportive of people, of course, safely and legally owning firearms, but, you know, we're not looking to allow people to illegally own or obtain firearms. I mean, that still needs to be enforced against and isn't allowed in general. Like, we're seeing a lot of misinformation coming out, unfortunately, with a charged bill like this. And I mean, part of your role as well, of course, is to make sure that we stop the proliferation of illegal firearms in the province as well, right?
Well, actually, we do quite a lot of that. So you might recall that last September, we obtained funding to expand our office in order to bring back some of the work that had previously been outsourced to New Brunswick in the past. And part of that expansion will be to create a unit specifically to coordinate with law enforcement on issues related to illegal trafficking, straw purchasing, 3D printing, and so on. And so we're proceeding full speed ahead on that. And I'd also mention that, you know, we do a lot of outreach at gun shows, and that's where we can monitor compliance. And if we see that people don't understand the law and therefore they're not complying with it, we can explain before it becomes an issue.
Yeah, and you mentioned straw purchasing. You know, since I have you, and some people may not understand what this is, and this concerns me as well. I think most firearm owners are kind of okay with licensing individuals. We want to make sure a person isn't a known criminal or violent person before we allow them to own a firearm. But something that does happen is sometimes a person who has a PAL will go out and buy a firearm on behalf of somebody else and bring it to them. And I don't want to see a registry. But like, this is one of the areas where people say, well, that's why you need a registry so you know who has the firearm and how they transfer it. How can we deal with straw purchasing without a registry?
Well, I think the there are a couple of things that we can do. And one is that I see that you've put up a picture of me. So you see, I'm a ventriloquist. I can talk without moving my lips.
Great work.
There are a number of things that we can do. So one thing is, which we do, and which also NWEST, which is a specialized law enforcement unit on illegal firearms trafficking, one of the things we do is educate retailers so that they're aware of the kind of situations that present themselves when somebody's doing straw purchasing. So there's certain behavioral cues that they present. And so educating people is one thing. Another thing that we can do is right now, since last July, there has been a requirement that people who are doing individual to individual transfers of non-restricted firearms obtain a reference number to demonstrate that they have verified that the person's PAL is valid, that it's not an illegal, you know, a counterfeit PAL or a stolen PAL or one that has been revoked, but somebody hasn't turned in. And so the way that in principle is a good idea, but the way they did it made it very hard for a lot of people to comply if you aren't very computer savvy, because most of these transfers happen either in the evening or on the weekends when you can't own this office in Miramichi that gives the numbers. So what we've arranged to do with the cooperation of the registry is that I now have staff at virtually every gun show, along with me, and we are able to call in on their behalf and obtain these reference numbers so that people can be sure that the person they're selling to has a valid PAL, that it's not lost or stolen or somehow otherwise illegitimate.
Well, that's great because, I'll be going to the big firearms show at the Seven Chiefs Center, for example, in early April. And, I mean, there's hundreds and hundreds of vendors there. And these are people who are, you know, aficionados, enjoy their firearms. But as you said, they're not necessarily tech savvy or immersed in that sort of thing. So, I mean, if we can help them along with those sorts of confirmations without being overbearing, that's a good proactive initiative.
Well, this is the kind of thing that we want to do because, as I've said a number of times, my whole goal is compliance through credibility, not compulsion. We make things easy for people to do. We don't try and beat them into submission with a club. And, you know, we're a regulatory agency. We're not law enforcement. And so our goal is just to ensure that people have, it's as easy as people for as possible for people to comply. And then that way, law enforcement never has to become involved. They've got more important things to do, tracking down people who are actually bad guys.
Yeah, so just to kind of pivot a little more before we wrap up, and you're coming to us, I believe, from Ottawa right now. So is part of your role, because it is kind of a newer role for Alberta still, I mean, you've been at it for a while now, but is a liaison then, I guess, to speak on behalf of Albertan firearm owners to Ottawa and in capacity such as that as well?
Yes. So that's very much a part of my role. So essentially, I have a dual role. On the one hand, I have to supervise the administration of the Firearms Act, like all the licensing of businesses and ranges and so on and so forth, as it currently exists in the law, but also the second part, which is something that is really only in our case and in Saskatchewan's case. The second part of my role is to advocate for, to make the law actually make sense. And that's a, that's actually probably the bigger problem, because most of our laws right now have only a tenuous connection to common sense or public safety values.
Yes, and I'm glad you're speaking up to those, because again, I mean, part of your role also isn't just speaking to firearm owners, but non-firearm owners who don't understand the issue in general. So to be able to reach out, you mentioned Saskatchewan, they've brought in a similar firearm legislation as well. Have you been in much communication with your Saskatchewan counterpart on this?
Well, we talk all the time, usually several times a week, and I spoke to CFO Freeberg just this morning. So, you know, it's we each have different circumstances because the nature of our provinces are different, and the nature of the law enforcement challenges are different. But we share a common goal of ensuring that the public is kept safe and that the law-abiding firearms community doesn't suffer a bunch of needless intrusion from people in Ottawa who don't know what they're doing.
Excellent. Well, I appreciate the work you do. I mean, trying to help people in Ottawa who don't know what they're doing understand what they're doing is a big task, and I appreciate your work on that file. And of course, you're coming on today to talk to us about it a bit. Is there anything more you'd like to add before I let you go?
Well, I think one of the key things, you know, when you look at our bill will enable us to do two things. One is, if the worst comes to worst and the feds do end up passing this bill, we'll be able to prevent some frauds through the licensing of anybody who's involved in it. And we'll also be able to create a body to provide legitimate, unbiased, solidly, empirically grounded estimates of the value of firearms, so that if the feds try and take somebody's gun, that they will be under a lot of pressure to actually pay what it's worth.
Well, I guess we could hope they don't take it in the first place, but if it does come about, then the compensation has to be somewhat fair. So thank you very much for coming on to talk to me today. I hope we can talk again soon, and I really appreciate that, such a proactive approach to this issue.
Well, thank you. I always look forward to chatting with you, Rory.
Great. Thanks, Terry.
I know.
All right. So that was Terry Bryant. That's Alberta's chief firearms officer. And, you know, it's important to talk to her and see, like, I really like this approach. This came about from the Kenny government. Just as she said, she's not there to be an authority figure or crack down or come down on people. It's trying to bring people up to compliance. I mean, to show an analogy, it reminds me of when I owned the restaurant. I had different experiences between inspectors. I had the Alberta liquor, gaming and liquor, who'd be on my case. And those guys were like police officers. They would come in and they would push me around. They were a real pain in the butt. On the other half, and I'm going to segue this into my next guest. Anyways, I had Alberta Health Services with my health inspector, and he was fantastic. And he would get in there and he would check my temperatures and the coolers, and he would make sure I was compliant. But he looked at his role of making sure, he wasn't trying to play gotcha. He wasn't trying to shut me down. He wasn't trying to catch me with things. He was just trying to make sure that I was always operating safely and up to code. It was looking at the matter not as a policeman, but as just somebody who's actually working with me to help things. And that's what I'm kind of seeing out of the role of the firearms officer coming from Alberta. Whereas out of Ottawa, they're looking to hit us with Alberta. We're just looking to help our law-abiding, and Terry said that repeatedly, law-abiding firearm owners, which is the vast majority of them. So I really am happy she's working on this and that the province is working in that way. Now, speaking of AHS, though, they aren't always seem to be looking out for our interests. It is a large bureaucracy with a lot of branches and tendrils, and part of it is our EMS system, which we're seeing across the country is having pressures and a really hard time all over the place. And there's been efforts from the Smith government to speed up our ambulance response times, some common sense fixes, but it sounds like AHS can really get in the way and be a pain. But I'm going to stop babbling on that and bring in, I've got Don Sharp in. He's a retired EMS paramedic. He's been on the show a number of times before now, I believe, and he's in studio with me today to talk about these things. So, hey, Don, good to see you back.
Corey, good to see you again. Thanks very much.
Oh, I appreciate you coming in this miserable weather. I mean, this winter's really hanging in this year.
Right? No bugs.
Yeah. So, I mean, I where to begin? There's so much to cover on this, but like...
Well, and there's been so much news lately, too. I mean, we've had that dysfunction in EMS article that came out in Alberta Views. We had This recent lights and siren report from Michael Corman, published by the Parkland Institute and funded by HSAA, the Union of Paramedics. We've had all this in the news lately about this email from a Foothills ER manager, I guess, to her staff, and somebody leaked it to the opposition and the legislature, and that caused a big brouhaha. I could talk about what's going on in healthcare for hours, Corey. I could.
Yeah, well, one I want to talk about, kind of start with the emails we had a couple of weeks ago before we booked you on. And one of the fixes we want to have, I mean, you've talked about these common sense fixes a lot for a long time, was patient transfer. You know, we're using fully staffed and equipped, you know, paramedical vehicles to move a low risk patient from one facility to another. That's taking people off the street who are specialized and trained for emergency response,
right,
and tying them up. So, I mean, it sounds like, okay, we're going to allow some other outside provision of these non-emergency transfers and that. But then they put out this notice for the bids that basically put it right out of bounds. It's like AHS is saying, oh, we're opening the door, but here, basically, you've got to provide us with a fully equipped ambulance if you're going to do it.
Well, and again, let's look at the basics of this problem is emergency ambulances, the critical care vehicles that look after the sickest patients, staffed by our very best paramedics, they're a finite resource. And to use those vehicles to transport patients who need a cast change or need to go in to get fitted for orthotics, that's like taking a limousine to the grocery store. It's way more vehicle than that person needs. So let's look at alternative transfers. Let's make sure that those critical care vehicles are available for our sickest patients. And isn't that the problem right now? Is a lot of them are stuck in the hospital hallway, right? And they're not available in the community to respond. So it's real easy for me to see the need for alternative transport. This should have been done years ago. But again, HS dragged its feet. I asked them numerous times to look at this issue and they refused. Well, now they're kind of being forced to. And let's remember when we talk about AHS and the government, they're two different things. AHS is the large bureaucracy that frequently takes instruction from the government or has in the past and gone, yeah, we'll get on that. Right. And then they either do it for 6 months and ignore it or just refuse to do it altogether. So now they've been instructed by the advisory committee to actually enable alternative transport, which right now, Corey, is happening. There's a paramedical company here in town right now that is taking phone calls from the Foothills Hospital. In fact, they have two trucks staged at the Foothills right now, private operators, to move patients out of the Foothills Emerge to places where they need to go, stable, non-emergent patients. And there's also, I know every day, because I talk to these people, I talk to the crews. They're taking calls, they're doing transfers from the Peter Lougheed to the Foothills, from cardiac rehab centers to nursing homes. It's happening now and it's happening with a phone call. Hi, medic, I need an ambulance to move a patient from the PLC to the Foothills. Can you do it by 2:30? Yep, no problem, click. So what's AHS's answer? That's the question. From what I understand, hearing about this new request for interest, is that AHS is going to try to put a mobile data terminal in every one of these transfer vehicles. These vehicles only have to be staffed to equipped to a minimum standard, I understand, with an AED and a basic first aid kit. They don't have a lot of equipment. They've got a couple of basic providers who are provincially registered. They're trained. They've been hired by a responsible business owner who probably this isn't his main business, some of them. A lot of them do oil field work. But they have high-quality vehicles. They have high-quality staff. They're able to start tomorrow moving patients. But AHS is going, we got to go through this whole big rigmarole. We got to make sure, we got to check your financial underwear. We got to have a quick pick at your details. And we got to make sure, I think it's onerous. I think it's irresponsible. And I don't think AHS can put any of these alternative transport vehicles in that fashion on the street until the end of June. And we need them today.
Well, and
we need them today.
And those vehicles are there now. I mean, I worked in the oil field for 20 years. They're fine vehicles. They're often, at this time of year, there's a lot of them sitting on standby, more than equipped enough to just take some of the load off. Every one of these vehicles that takes somebody from hospital to hospital means that you've got some highly trained paramedics are now available somewhere else.
Right.
But
so here's the question. Who's enabling these transfers, making them happen, and who's blocking them at AHS? Well, the people who are making it happen are brave unit managers at some of the hospitals who say, look, I have three patients in my Emerge. I've got a lot of people waiting in the hallway to get into Emerge. I need these patients taken back to the nursing home right now not 6 hours from now, not tomorrow, right now. So I'm going to phone a private company and they're going to come and get these patients. They're going to move them where they need to go and they send the bill to Alberta Health and they get paid. Mm-hmm. And it's a reasonable fee. They're not grossly, they're not overcharging or gouging anybody. And they're getting the patients moved safely and quickly. Those brave unit managers are succeeding in this. Now, there's unit managers at urgent cares in places like Cochrane and Okotoks who frankly refuse. Say, I don't care what happens, I'm not calling. I'm going to call AHS. I want an AHS ambulance because I don't want to get in trouble. So those patients, remember, some of these urgent cares close at 10 o'clock at night. If there's a serious patient in the urgent care in Okotoks, Cochrane, any one of these places, 10 o'clock comes, the urgent care closes, but that patient's still there waiting for transport. So now the urgent care manager has to keep a nurse and sometimes a doctor overnight at overtime to look after people that if they had simply called somebody else, if there was somebody else available they could call, that patient would get moved to the hospital.
So we got a big bureaucracy. You got levels and levels, unfortunately, yep, of resistance. I mean, that's the hard thing with a big ship. It just doesn't turn easily.
Forever.
You did mention the union, and I mean, the unions have been excellent for the paramedics in highlighting, for example, the way rural ambulances have been drained and pulled into the city and misappropriated, in my view. But at the same time, isn't there a bit of the resistance, I guess, when it comes to, because that's instinctive for a lot of unions. Well, we don't want to allow private in here, though. We can't let another group come in here and start taking
care
of it.
Well, look at this latest report by Michael Corman, published by the Parkland Institute, commissioned by HSAA, the union. Neither one of them are interested in talking about privatization. They're very much against it. And I would support 100% public health care if they could do the job. But I think AHS and especially EMS have proven they can't. We simply don't have the vehicles or the staff to move patients right now. And I'm not talking about we could grow more paramedics. Do you remember that article, Bill McFarlane published? He blamed the lack of paramedics these days on the low birth rate over the last several years. I laughed so hard. He wouldn't call me back. I don't think he wanted to talk about it. It takes time to train paramedics and buy trucks. New ambulances, by the way, from, you can look it up, wheeled coach type 3, brand new ambulances, $240,000 US. That's prohibitive.
$250,000.
It's a huge investment. So we've got responsible business owners who own these trucks. They maintain them, frankly, better than AHS. I used to work on an ambulance not too long ago for AHS. Their vehicles are not well maintained. They are not clean.
You sent me that picture of the gas tank, a simple maintenance issue.
There's so many of those. They don't manage their own fleet very well, and yet they want to be able to micromanage a responsible private business owner's fleet and their staff. It's frustrating. It's frustrating to see this unfolding.
And it's frustrating to see the non-cooperative and, unfortunately, the reality politicized attitude of trying to make sure that the current government isn't successful no matter what they try. I mean, I'm really seeing some of that.
Yeah,
and when there was that leaked email about the memo, and everybody lit their hair on fire, and suddenly the government's on its heels and backtracking because the memo saying, we want these ambulances out of here within 45 minutes.
Yeah. And what did Notley say in the ledge? She said, patients are going to get dumped in a merge. Okay, let's back the truck up. Number one, that letter, that email was written internally from a manager at the ER to her staff. And quite frankly, I think that's an email written by a weak leader. That whole attitude of that was, we're going to fail, look out. You know what? That 45-minute target time, that's a target. It's not a hard stop on March 15th, 45 minutes, we're going to leave. No, I mean, nurses and paramedics are very responsible. We're never just going to drop people and run away. That's especially if they need extra care. So that's a target time. March 15th was going to be a slow rollout. It wasn't well publicized, but the medics and the nurses knew about it. We're all kind of cooperating. What's the goal here? The goal is to move patients into the hospital in a timely and efficient manner so that we can then extricate the medics out of the hospital, get them back into the communities where they serve, so that patients aren't waiting an hour for. Corey, you know, people are scared. Like we have all of these citizen action groups, and that is the primary comment now on most of our citizen action groups is, you know what, I'm afraid. I'm afraid that if I call an ambulance, I'm not going to be able to get one. I might have to drive my mom to the hospital myself.
And setting a target at 45 minutes to get somebody in, drop off, do the paperwork, do the transfer, and get out. I mean, that's the goal. And that's a long, I mean, that sounds unreasonably long already.
It's twice as long as we used to drop them off. And not only that, but the Canadian standard for turnaround times in hospitals in Emerge is 45 minutes. Alberta is the outlier right now with AHS's 90-minute turnaround time. It's and it's gone on far too long. Like I said, they've had years to fix this. And again, making it clear the government can only do so much. There's legislation that prevents them from moving too quickly to make changes at AHS. That's for a reason. But AHS has got a responsibility here that they've failed to fulfill. And I think at the end of the day, this is a leadership problem. And we need erasing the board, the healthcare board, was a great move. Moving on from having our chief paramedic in charge, and now we have a provincial lead, a provincial head of EMS, Athana Metzalopoulos. You know, she's done some work before with the red tape reduction project. I think she's very skilled. So I'm looking forward to some positive changes. But again, alternative transport, that should be happening right now. Not next week, not 2 weeks from now, not 3 months from now, certainly. The vehicles and the equipment and the people are ready to do it right now. And they're needed right now.
Well, yeah, and it's a solution in front of our faces. I mean, a lot of the things that, again, we listen to, and I won't even go left, right. We're hearing it in every province, but they're saying, we need more money, more money. Well, no, if there's only a finite number of bodies, you can pump all the money in there that you want. I mean, if we're talking about nurses and doctors. But yeah. When we are talking about patient transfer, actually, we do have the means handy. We have the trucks. We have the people.
Yeah.
Money will take care of that.
And it's not expensive. That's the thing. These guys aren't looking for a windfall. I'm not sure exactly what the financial structure is going to be. I hear it's going to be a flat fee based on so many transfers a day. Here's the interesting thing, though. What AHS wants is total control of these private operators' resources. In other words, they want to put an MDT in the truck, a computer, so the crews have to learn how to use that. They want to control. Here there's going to be a rule that they can't refuse a transfer. So if you're offered a transfer or you're told to do a transfer at the end of the day that's going to run you past the end of your shift, that's fine. In EMS, we understand late trips. But if it's going to happen 3 times out of 4 shifts that you end up doing a late trip, I mean, this is what they're doing to the Emerge crews now. Keeping them late, running them hard, burning them out.
Yeah.
And that's why 40% of them are off sick. So again, I don't see, I've talked to some of these people who work as they used to work for AHS. But now they've left AHS. They don't want anything to do with AHS EMS. And they've gone to work for these private operators. They say, what are you going to do the first time somebody says you have to stay late and do a transfer? He goes, huh, that's not going to go well.
Well, and unfortunately,
that's why I left.
It sets up some of the conflict potentially, too. And that's what I get fearful of when they start basically already creeping in and turning these alternative transport vehicles into full-out ambulances. You give it 2 more years. Next thing you know, well, now we're going to require you to be unionized. Now we're going to require your certification to be up to paramedic level. Next thing you know, you're back to basically AHS ambulances on the road again that can be tied up very expensively doing patient transfers that we were trying to avoid in the first place.
Yeah, that kind of creep. I guess I hadn't thought of that. It's certainly possible. My focus is the immediate problem right now of just the patient who's right now in the High River Hospital. She's an inpatient. She needs a stretcher to get to South Health Campus to get an MRI. Right now, the nurses will phone and say, I need an ambulance tomorrow to move a patient on a stretcher for MRI. If she doesn't make that appointment, that MRI sits empty, she doesn't get looked after, and that's happening over and over and over. And that can be changed. That's a stable stretcher patient that could go. Now, here's the other problem. This alternative transport issue that AHS has got planned isn't going to affect any communities outside of a 50-kilometer radius from Calgary or Edmonton, big centers. So if you live in Banff or Canmore, you're outside. No, that's not going to affect you. Or if you live in Sundry. Sundry right now is moving patients sometimes by taxi to the city. And their concern at the hospital is who's going to pay for that? So when I heard that question, I said, send it to Alberta Health Services. Send it to the same people these other paramedical outfits send. I mean, that should be paid for by this organization, AHS, that said they were going to take care of EMS and inter-hospital transfers and, quite frankly, isn't doing a good job. They're not doing a good job now. Now they want to take on the additional monster of alternative transport.
Take some of this off our hands because we got a million other things
right.
We're dealing
with. And AHS believes that there's no amount of managers that they can hire. We're always going to need one more manager. So that's another, I think the whole thing's crazy. They're not doing themselves a service. They're not doing patients any service. And I'd like to see them move forward with a quicker solution.
Well, we've been talking about it for years, and that's part of the issue. And I mean,
should have happened years ago.
Governments move very slowly with it. Yeah. To we keep bringing up. I mean, it was that horrific case of that woman who was attacked by dogs, and definitely could have possibly been saved with a quicker response. She was a 10-minute drive from the biggest hospital in Alberta.
So let me jump on this. Another little side note here: The Health Quality Council of Alberta. They're the ones who did the report on the fatal dog bite. They left out all of the issues with leadership. They didn't mention leadership and poor leadership at not even once. I spoke. I phoned them and said, can I come in and talk to you? In 2018, I went to the Health Quality Council. I made a presentation. I said, your little focus website you have with all the times. I said, keep some EMS stats, response times, hospital turnaround times, hospital wait times. Oh, yeah, we can't do that. We're really busy. I said, no, this is important, and this is healthcare. This is EMS. This is hospital. Yeah, no, we're too busy. I got blown off by them two or three times. And you know what? Now I see them doing this fatal dog bite review, and I go, you guys dropped the ball. Health Quality Council of Alberta dropped the ball 4 years ago. They could have got in front of this and actually been part of the solution rather than sweeping up the mess with this report on that fatal dog bite attack.
So getting on to the solution, you're trying piecemeal. We've got things that are proposed here and there, but again, you got that big, monstrous leviathan of a bureaucracy with the AHS. What can government or people or just anybody do? How? That's the hardest question. I mean, you know the solutions, but how can we get this machine to embrace the solutions?
Well, the first thing you got to do is you got to talk to the people that are doing the work. Right now, the only time they talk to the people that have solutions or make suggestions is they punish them. Take a look at that paramedic right now who's been disciplined multiple times
for speaking
up, simply FOIPing documents and going and speaking to a reporter. Brave kid. He's a brave guy. He's got a family. He could lose his job. He won't quit fighting. And it's unfortunate that's what it has to come to. And again, that's a leadership issue. You want my opinion of what we should do now, the first thing we should do? So we should start replacing some of the people that are leaders in this organization, not just EMS, but the hospitals too. Quite frankly, how many years have they had to solve issues like access block, moving patients from eMERGE into the hospital? And I hear all the time, number one, it's a long-term care problem. Okay, great, you've got a problem, not an EMS problem, right? And then they tell me, well, we're all on the same team for patient care. I say, well, I agree. We're all on the same team for patient care in the hospital. But don't forget, when it's 3 o'clock in the morning, it's 40 below, and I'm in a ditch on the side of a highway at an overturned car, I don't see anybody from the hospital on my team. That's an EMS responsibility. You know, picking people up who've been hurt and are sick critically in communities, that's my job.
Well, and that's a specialized skill. It takes a certain kind of person to do it. Just as an EMS, a paramedic, wouldn't necessarily be a good nurse. I mean, that's
heavens,
a separate skill,
right?
As well.
I know people who are both nurses and paramedics. They're fantastic people. And I know terrific practitioners who are able to straddle that. I never could. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was a good paramedic at best. You know, I've worked with some great, great clinicians, great paramedics. I think some of the things that I've seen are process issues. You know, why is this taking so long? Where's the paperwork? Why am I here when this has to be done? And again, in EMS, you know, when you show up on a call and somebody's critically ill, we're trained to move very quickly. And then we drive lights and siren to the hospital and you give report to triage and they send you down the hallway and you're going, are you kidding? Like, this guy's sick. But their process is different and their problems are different. Now, back to my original point, which is if you can't find somebody to fix these hospital problems, start replacing people.
Well, and there's something. I mean, consequences for senior managers. Something I want to bring up is, I mean, AHS, it was a representative who was caught in an outright lie. That was on the documentary, the great one with CTV with Kathy Lee.
Yep.
When he said, we do not discipline people for speaking up. And then right after it pops up, well, here's one being disciplined for speaking up. Now, there should be consequences for him lying to the public on a critical issue like this.
Yeah.
There was no consequence.
You know, it's funny. One of the managers mentioned, well, he retired. And I go, well, did he retire or was there? And he goes, actually, we can't talk about it. I said, well, if you can't talk about it, he probably didn't just retire, did he? So, and that's more of that needs to happen. But again, what's the biggest problem after leadership is transparency and accountability, AHS. AHS doesn't want people FOIPing data. They make it very difficult to actually get. And they, you know, these presentations that EMS goes out to, They send executive directors out to speak to these town councils in these small towns, and they just baffle them with all this gibberish, which is what it is. If it's medicine, right? And it's all these statistics and a PowerPoint. And really, town councils should be going, wait, I don't need any more information. Where's my ambulance? I want it here when my people need it. And that should be just a line in the sand. And like Jeff Ganung, the mayor of Cochrane, said after the last presentation in Cochrane, he said, look, people here are scared. And after years of asking for better service, trust has been eroded. People don't trust AHS anymore. He says, we got to repair that.
Well, and you've been very active in Cochrane out there. I mean, you've got some great people working on things out there and doing stuff.
Great group.
And part of what the last time you were in talking with me, we talked about was some efforts in municipalities to say, you know what, screw you guys. We'll take care of it ourselves. We will do it. And but that's where we're seeing the creep with AHS. Well, we're going to find ways to regulate this out of existence, too.
Well, like, here's an interesting one. Fire departments. You saw what happened in the MD of Willow Creek. The MD of Willow Creek bought three ambulances. Now, you can't call them that because it's called against the law. Yeah. It's a fire department, paramedical response, whatever. It's an ambulance. So they bought three of them. And they put one in Fort McLeod and Claire's home in Nanton because they saw repeatedly that they were spending long time on scene with critical patients who they needed to move. And how many times, I think Canmore, just last weekend moved a patient in the fire truck to the hospital. We don't have a lot of details. We don't need a lot of details. We've all heard the stories. But now, and I think it's my opinion, and this is what I've told people, is every fire department in Alberta should have an ambulance, a fire paramedical response vehicle. Yeah. But if for three reasons. Number one, you go to a big fire, that's a good place to rehab your firefighters. Get them in, take a pressure if you need to. Number two, it's a safe place to look after people at a car crash on the highway, out of the elements. You got a place where you can literally sit eight people so they're not freezing cold, sitting in their overturned car or standing on the side of the road. And three, it's a place you can use as a base for treatment. You go over and you find a lady who's fallen and broken her hip in her driveway. You're going to leave her in the snow for 40 minutes till AHS gets there, or are you going to put her in a nice warm bus design? And number four, if you have to transport, giddy up. You phone medical control. You say, listen, I got a lady here who's really sick. AHS is too far away. Hospital's 10 minutes away. We'd like to go.
Well, and again, and that's giddy that overlap up. Of the skills too.
Exactly.
We know that there's a degree of emergency health training for firefighters, but they are firefighters. Their primary role is getting that fire out. We don't expect a paramedic to go into a place where there's propane tanks ready to blow and knowing what to do with that. And we don't expect a firefighter to be the best paramedic around.
Well, hang on. I'll disagree with you there because Cochrane has a number of, I think they have 8 or 10 people who are trained to the absolute top paramedic level. A lot of them work part-time for EMS. They're terrific practitioners. I would work with any one of them. I would let them treat my family. They're terrific paramedics. There's also small services, volunteer services in towns where they really have the minimum MFR, medical first responder training. And they do a great job too. They can do CPR, they can stop the bleeding, they can hold somebody's head still in a crash. But, you know, there's lots of fire departments who quite frankly could run an ambulance service tomorrow better than AHS could. And I encourage every fire department to get an FPRV.
And I won't devolve into the prettiest issues as we have in my area. I mean, and our proximity to the city means we are constantly drained of our local resources, and it's frustrating.
Prettiest is known as the bitch truck. Nobody wants to work it because it's never there.
No, it's too close to the city. It's just there, for the taking.
Yeah, it goes to cover everywhere else, and it just means that maybe you don't deserve the same coverage as the city. Yeah, it doesn't sit well, does it?
No.
Sure doesn't.
They've got a resident down there who's going to make more noise about that yet.
That's good to hear.
All right. Well, there's so much to cover. I mean, it goes fast when I have you in, Don. We'll have to have you back because this issue is just so frustrating, so stupid, so relatively easy at least to bring in some solutions. And we've got resistance to those solutions. It just ticks me off every time. I really appreciate that you keep bringing it up and highlighting it and putting this stuff on the web and Facebook and such. So before I let you go, where can people find more info? Because I know people are concerned everywhere with this one, but it's a shotgun approach.
Right, because you're seeing it in the news all the time. So we found Facebook to really be really effective. Citizen action groups in each community are springing up and people are working together to try to put pressure on on AHS locally and also on their town councils, give them good advice and back them up. And I really hope that RJ Sigurdsson, who's doing great work as the parliamentary secretary, I really hope that he starts touring around the province and meeting with people in these towns and talking about EMS and encourage people locally, especially in the smaller communities, to get together and start working on solutions. Call me anytime. You can find me on the web.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Don, and I'm sure we'll be talking again.
Thanks, Corey.
All right. So that was Don Sharp. He's been here before, as I said, and he's very active online. He's active on the ground. He comes out to towns. He speaks. He helps. I mean, he's not waiting for somebody else to get it done, and I just really appreciate that. We've got to. That's part of that attitude, saying, you know, we've got this big machine. It's going to fight. It's going to try to avoid turning, and the only way that's going to get fixed is if we take it up ourselves and put that pressure on. They're not going to willingly do it. And that's what Don's been doing. As Luther is saying, he is sharp. Yes, he is indeed. And it's a good play on words. And I really, really appreciate what he does. Okay, as I said, we've got a really tight show today. So I'm going to pop right into our next guest quite quickly here. We'll run a quick ad before we get there too as well. But and we will speak a little more on the local level of politics. So it's Chelsea Petrovic. She's a nomineeor running for the nomination down in Livingston McLeod. And things are getting pretty hotly contested as we got a spring election that's going to hit us in just a couple of months here. So the UCP has really kind of put off the nominations right to the bitter end in some ways. But I guess when you're changing leaders and things get backed up. So let's go to Chelsea when we can here. And we'll have a conversation. Hey, Chelsea, how you doing? Oh, you're outside.
Yeah, sorry, you guys. You got me out while I'm campaigning. So you get me while I'm live streaming on the back of the car while we're hitting doors.
I understand. So, yes, it's a nomination is a lot of work, and that's the way to do it, is hammering on doors. To give a little bit of background, I guess it was Roger Reed is the incumbent. He's not going to run again. And you've got a number of other people running for that nomination right down there in Livingston McLeod. Is that correct?
Yeah, there was initially, I believe, 8 of us, and now we're down to 3. So I'm hoping to be number one on that ballot coming here Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and be the voice for Livingston McLeod. We know we haven't had one for a long time, and it's time we bring back the politicians back to Ralph Klein days, where we have some more people politicians and less party politicians.
Well, you note there hasn't been a voice for a long time. I mean, there was a UCP MLA there. I got to admit, Roger Reed wasn't one that you really saw or heard a heck of a lot of. We have that problem in some constituencies sometimes. Is that part of what the issue is down there right now?
Yeah, the biggest concern, I think, as I go door to door, is the voices haven't been heard for the last number of years. You know, people are quite concerned about that. I've had people that have tried reaching out every day for months on end with no response. So we're hoping to change that here. We've been hitting the ground extremely hard, listening to everyone's concerns. And it's actually, most people are surprised to see a politician come to their door in this riding. And hopefully we can make that change and start having the politicians that are going to work for the people instead of the other way around.
So what prime issue is your campaign riding on at this point down in that constituency?
Well, I think the first and foremost, we're extremely excited to have a potential politician that is willing to get out there, willing to start listening to all of the concerns across the riding. A biggest thing for us here in Livingston McLeod is the continual overreach. We're worried about that federal government and how they continue to dabble in stuff that's not necessarily their business. So hoping we can move forward in a positive direction and start making choices at that local level. And you know, what we here in Livingston McLeod, we kind of know what's best for us here. So let's move on towards that positive process and tell the federal government to back off a bit.
Right on. So what's the timeline on your nomination? Before I let you go, I know it's a quick hit and you look pretty chilly out there. So is the membership cutoff passed already, or is it still going? Where are you sitting with the nomination right now?
So the nomination has cut off. It cut off on February 16th. We didn't have a lot of time to sell the memberships, unfortunately. The voting dates will take place on the 9th, 10th, and 11th across all of the nominations. So it's six locations, six different times over a period of 3 days. So if anyone's looking for more information, I have that on my website at chelseapetrovic.com. You're able to vote at any voting location, but they have tried to spread it across the constituency as much as possible.
Great. Well, thank you for taking a moment out of the door knocking to join us out in that cold there. I'll let you get back at it and maybe warm up. When you shake hands with cold fingers, it can make the wrong impression sometimes. So thanks for talking to us today. I always appreciate and enjoy watching, you know, a contested nomination. I think that's important in some of these constituencies that get taken for granted. So thanks for talking to us today, and perhaps we'll check in again down the road.
Perfect. Thanks so much for having me, you guys. Have a great day.
Great. Thank you. So just that reminder, that was Chelsea Petrovic at chelseapetrovic.com. CA, I believe she said, and it's a nomination that's running down Livingston McLeod. And part of the problems we have in those constituencies, they're strong conservative constituencies, they get taken for granted. You sometimes get those people who get in there, as perhaps he was sort of noting. And I had that issue with an MLA I had before, too, and it was Wild Roses. Sometimes they get in and they just want to coast and ride. And, hey, you know what? It's not supposed to be there just for a job to ride on and get a good salary and a little bit of profile. You got to be active. You got to be pushing. You got to take those issues up. Hopefully that constituency gets a person who will do those things for them. Because, I mean, again, shy. I know somebody else pointing out saying, you know, we need independence, not more UCP. Yeah, fair enough. But the reality is, with the polling in Livingston McLeod and some of them, I mean, unless something incredible happens, it's going to be a UCP MLA. So the real race for that is the nomination that's happening right now. So we just had Chelsea pop in to speak on that. And as I said, there's a lot of nominations that they've put off right to the end. They're happening. They got a whole bunch to get done in this next couple of months. We're still watching things unfolding in Rimby, Rocky Mountain House, I think it is. And that's where Jason Nixon's pretty embattled, and that's going back and forth. They're trying to stop the nomination there. I know opponents to the UCP love pointing at that there's still some internal division and infighting going on, and there is. It never seems to stop. So, it's tough. Vlad saying, when will people stop voting uniparty? Seriously, I guess frustrated with party lines, but, you know, I could be paraphrasing the wrong person. I think it was Churchill saying, you know what, democracy is the worst system on earth, except for all the other ones. Like, there's no perfect way. The only main thing is take part, participate, get up, get out there. And, follow that theme with Don, who was in here talking about EMS and what he's been trying to do, trying to engage communities, rural communities, urban communities. Get up there, fix your own EMS, because the current one isn't going to do it. So, lots of stuff breaking, lots of stuff going on. This was a really packed show. Next week, I got something really special going on. We're going to have Tamara Leach. I'm going to talk to her one-on-one. We're going to have a good conversation. I mean, there's certain things she cannot talk about, and it's fair enough. She's still, you know, working her way through the courts and all that stuff. But she's been speaking and coming out publicly again, which is good. And you know, it's going to be a very interesting conversation. I'm really looking forward to that. So don't miss next week's show, guys, because she doesn't talk to a lot of press. She understands, well, for one, there's legal challenges. And, of course, the mainstream media is not her friend. It's not your friend either. So there's that reminder. Guys, before I let you go, if you haven't subscribed already, take out a subscription and a membership of the Western Standard. That's how we pay our bills. That's how we stay away from being beholden to the government or any government. And, $10 a month, it helps support us keep these shows going, keep our columnists going, keep our reporters going across this country. So thank you all for joining me today, guys. I appreciate it. It was really a packed show. I didn't get to do most of my ranting that I normally do because we had a whole bunch of guests, but that's okay. I will have plenty more ranting to go, and I will see you again next week at this time.
The current Lethbridge feed grain prices are unchanged, with cash barley at $4.17, feed wheat at $4.32, and corn at $425 per ton. In the milling wheat markets, May Minneapolis futures are down 10.25 cents at $8.42, with local hard red spring bid for April movement at $10.95 per bushel. In the oilseeds, nearby canola futures lost $2.40 at $810.50 per ton, with delivered values for April at $17.92 per bushel. In the pulse markets, nearby red lentil prices are unchanged at 33 cents per pound, and yellow peas are trading at $12.50 per bushel. In the cattle markets, April live cattle decreased 90 cents at $165.08 per hundredweight. I'm David Lee at Marketplace Commodities. Accurate real-time marketing information and pricing options.
Canadian Shooting Sports Association. Without the CSSA, our gun rights would have been taken long, long ago. These guys are on the front lines, helping to draft smart and intelligent firearms regulations and legislation in Canada. And more importantly, educating the public about how we keep guns out of the hands of the wrong people. Become a member. It's absolutely worth every penny.